listening to Expansion on RBN, republicbroadcasting.org. I am Sophia, your host, and today's show is going to be rather different. I was flying back from San Jose to San Diego, and I had a copy of Harper's Magazine with me. Harper's has long been a favorite of mine because its articles occasionally explore some very extraordinary subjects to great depth. And this particular issue was February 2008, and I encourage people to take a look at Harper's. You can get it at bookstores. You can get it at the library. It is phenomenal. This is, we're not talking about Harper's Bazaar, the fashion magazine. This is the intellectual Harper's. And I will tell you and read to you from this particular article for hopefully the first hour of today's show. The title is Wasteland, and this article concerns itself with what happens after we flush the toilet. There is a world of activity after that point, and it is shocking. It is full of experimentation, money, the apparent effort to help and save our Earth. And in the second part of this show, I'm going to invite William Roberts on. He is also an RBN host, and he has had experience in urban planning, land use development, civil engineering, and he will have something to say about this particular article, which raises an awful lot of questions for me. So I will begin to read the piece, and the breaks will, of course, be the breaks, but you, I hope, will follow along. I am going to eliminate large swaths of this article because it goes into a lot of history, the history of human waste, and I can't pronounce some of these very big, long Egyptian words and so forth, but I'll do my best, and you're going to get the most salient bits. And after that, I hope I'll have some callers, and William Roberts will certainly be able to edify all of us. So here I go. Wasteland, February 2008, Harper's Magazine. In 1998, John Brunston bought a house in Yorktown Heights, a suburb of New York City. His wife decorated bedrooms for their three daughters, and Brunston planted a cherry tree and an American flag. Then came the spring rains, and Brunston discovered a dark fountain of human waste bubbling up from his backyard. He did everything he could to stop the sickening flow. He consulted engineers, installed a new septic tank, purchased sump pumps, dumped ton after ton of fresh soil over the ooze. He spent tens of thousands of dollars, but the evil-smelling gloop still percolated to the surface. Brunston lives in a densely populated, well-established neighborhood. He should not have to use a septic tank. His waste should flow into the underground pipe that lies no more than 30 feet from his front door, and that pipe should carry the Brunston family waste far from the Brunston family home. But neither John Brunston nor anyone else on this lovely block of Yorktown Heights, I guess we're going into break now. You're listening to Expansion on republicbroadcasting.org. I'm Sophia, your host, and I am reviewing an article from the 2008 February issue of Harper's called Wasteland. So I'm going to continue reading here. But neither John Brunston nor anyone else on this lovely block of Yorktown Heights can hook up to a sewer because the sewers of Yorktown Heights are already full. In fact, they are running at 100,000 gallons of waste per day beyond capacity. So Brunston's backyard must absorb Brunston's waste, and it cannot. Every day, America must find a place to park 5 billion gallons of human waste. In Durham, North Carolina, sewage has reared up from the depths and gurgled across the city sidewalks at an alarming rate of once every 11 days. North Carolina has notched up more than 2,000 such spills, both urban and suburban, and the state of Oregon fined Portland $500,000 for 67 overflows. Local newspapers from Tulsa to Allentown described the same nightmare. Reeking goo invades family basement and living room. Unclear who will pay for the mess. This sounds like a problem. For thousands of years, Homo sapiens flocked across continents in pursuit of bird, beast, and fresh water, leaving behind him a trail of gnawed bones and steaming waste. The moment we stopped removing ourselves from that waste, it had to be removed from us. Thus the origins of civilization, thus the glories of Rome, Paris, and Philadelphia, thus the horror of John Brunston's backyard. The first regulations with respect to waste go back to the Code of Hammurabi, says Steve Askew, superintendent of New York's North River Wastewater Treatment Plant, one of the world's largest. People wake up in the morning, they flush the toilet, they think it goes to the center of the earth. If you happen to live within one particular 5,100-acre patch of the west side of Manhattan, instead of going to the center of the earth, your waste flows to Askew's extraordinary concrete cesspit, 28 concrete acres suspended above more than 2,000 concrete caissons sunk into the shallows between the West Side Highway and the Hudson River. Constructed in the 1970s, topped by three swimming pools, a skating rink, and a carousel, North River cost the city $1 billion, $100 million of which went straight into odor control. North River is just one of New York City's 14 wastewater treatment plants, the first of which opened in 1886 along with the Statue of Liberty. These plants handle every conceivable kind of sewerable waste from the city's 8 million permanent residents, not to mention anything a commuter or a tourist might care to add. They separate the material that comes their way into solid, liquid, and gaseous parts, which they further subdivide into that which must be discarded, that which may be consumed, and that which someone, somewhere, might eventually be able to sell. The substance that enters North River is mostly water, and the vast majority of that water leaves the plant after not much more than 6 hours, disinfected to the extent that it can merge inoffensively with the Hudson River. One flush on the Upper West Side at 7 in the morning, and by 3 in the afternoon, the water is back on the street, so to speak. What's left over is 500,000 gallons of concentrated daily waste, now known as sludge. Right now, we're at 135 million gallons per day. The greatest increase occurs between 8 and 9 in the morning, when the city's output swells from 70 million to 150 million gallons per day. This is known as the Big Flush. At 4 in the morning, North River takes in 68 million gallons per day. The rhythm is as steady as the tides. By the time the morning flush finally rolls in, it has joined the downstream flow of all the other morning flushes from all the other sewage lines, from Bank Street to the Upper West Side, and sunk 54 feet below sea level. It is here at the extreme low point of this immense underground current that North River gets to work. In the Stygian depths, its mighty diameter swollen to 16 feet, the dark torrent branches into 6 channels, each of which must be pumped to the top floor of the plant, where gravity can once again take hold and set the outcast on a new journey. The glorious future of waste. Now that biochemists can scour the particles on the atomic level, the plant can recover ibuprofen, acetaminophen, endocrine disruptors, DEET, Prozac, and Chanel No. 5. Even caffeine can be extracted from the mix. 20 years from now, we will be removing things we have no idea about, says Askew. Penicillin, mercury, heroin. Will this be a pharmaceutical business, an energy business, an agribusiness? A bear goes in the woods and it takes 2 years to decompose. We do it in 6 hours. In 6 hours, we imitate all of nature from the Big Bang to the Big Chill. We're trying to put it back the way that God intended. The North River Wastewater Treatment Plant creates sparkling, fresh, nutrient-rich sludge. In the old days, the night soil collector would spread spread such promising stuff on village crops, but in these days of refinement and paranoia, sludge requires a few more alchemical interventions and changes of venue. Thus did I find myself on the bridge of a sludge boat next to a pot-bellied man who swiveled his chair and checked the radar. "Where the secret?" said Captain Jonas. Captain Jonas is from Flushing, and he told me about the story he had read the other day that said that New York City has the fourth largest navy in the world. "For a municipality to have its own fleet of tankers is unheard of," he said. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, the New York City Navy moves New York City waste. The boat plowed past United Nations, and not one diplomat who gazed out the window could have suspected his part in our journey to the heart of darkness. Half a nautical mile below Wall Street, we would hang a right, then head up Harlem's western shore. Our mission, to pick up a single load of 700,000 gallons of waste from North River and carry it towards Island in the Bronx, where the sludge could be transformed into cake. The sludge boat stretched longer than a football field and packed two massive propellers, two titanic cranes, 3,000 horsepower, and one frighteningly distended black rubber Goodyear hose, the diameter of which matched the length of my leg. We all knew what would go through that hose. Captain Jonas pulled back the throttle and the sludge boat quaked, lurched, and churned past the Statue of Liberty. I asked him about the future of human waste. "You can divert it, but you can't stop it," he said. "It's a problem now. It'll be a problem in the future." We bowled past Governor's Island, which is rumored to have no sewage system. I asked Captain Jonas what happened to Governor Island's waste. "It drops into the upper bay," Jonas said. "Straight into the water?" I asked. Now Captain Jonas gave me the look. The ban on ocean dumping was rammed down people's throats. 50 years from now, we'll probably be ocean dumping again. This is cyclical. The great concrete mass of North River loomed ahead, and the plant staff donned their hard hats and work gloves and readied themselves for pumping. Captain Jonas marched outside. "Right 20," he roared to the first mate. One of the onboard cranes lifted the mighty black snake, and the plant workers grabbed the hose, wrestled it into position, and gave the ready signal. Someone turned a valve. The hose jumped and twitched. The ship trembled with the force, and a sour smell began to rise. "Gotta go," cried Captain Jonas. As the boat filled with waste, I descended the stairway to the main deck. One of the hard hats was embracing the rank and monstrous intestine, trying to hold the writhing rubber steady, and I gave him plenty of leeway. But after a while, I stepped toward the hose, touched my palm to the warmth, and felt the cosmic surge. The veneration of human waste boasts a noble history. Among the verdant passes of the Himalayas, intrepid Jesuit missionaries discovered cult worship of multicolored powders and hand-fashioned pills produced from the dried and pulverized ejecta of the Grand Lama, which the Buddhists wore as amulets around their necks. Some of the Mongols painstakingly packed the holy relics within golden boxes. Others consumed it as a sacred snuff. Still others as a rare condiment. What could be more magical, more godlike, than the metamorphosis of that which we abhor and expel into that which we desire, embrace, and ingest? The exorcism rites of the Abyssinians demanded waste, as did the oblations of the Ojibwa and the Huron, the Iroquois and the Eskimo, the Mojave and the Patagonians. The ancient doctors Hippocrates, Xenocrates, and Dioscorides employed plasters and poultices and styptics and decoctions of waste to treat holy diseases such as epilepsy and mania. Physicians paid close attention to filth remedies for the plague and boils, headache and insomnia, dementia and insanity, not to mention anorexia, cancer, cataracts, convulsions, constipation, and freckles. Like the Romans and the Moabites and lovesick maidens in France, the alchemists of Europe believed in the spiritual powers of human waste, which ranked among the strongest of all magnetic medicines. The great Paracelsus, father of modern pharmacology, kept a store from which he hoped to conjure nothing less than the philosopher's stone. "Man's dung or excrement hath very great virtues," he wrote, "because it contains in it all the noble essences." I stood on the floor amid the roar of 13 German-made Humboldts and watched as Joe Pace, a 21-year Department of Environmental Protection veteran, turned one of them off and leaned down to scoop out a few tablespoons of black carbony dust. The sludge from the North River had been dried and shrunk into fine gravel, and the smell was amazing. Overcome the repression, I told myself. Transcend it. Do not mind the pain. Tears drip down my cheeks. We're going for break.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
You're listening to Expansion on RBN, republicbroadcasting.org. I'm Sophia, your host, and today I'm reviewing a subject that I knew very little about. I'm reading from an article, the February 2008 issue of Harper's Magazine. The article is called Wasteland. We are back on the huge waste barge on the Hudson River, heading towards the Bronx, Ward's Island, with Captain Joe. Tears drip down my cheeks. It takes a while to get used to it, said Joe. He flipped the switch, and as the centrifuge started back up, I touched the blue cast iron and felt the vibrations of the orbit, felt the warmth. Joe kept his cake at body temperature. He turned an orange knob, and clear fluid poured out the bottom of the tank and pooled on the floor, not too far from my loafers. He shined his flashlight on the discharge. Not bad, he said. Pretty clean. A dark conveyor belt shuttled the black dust from the blue centrifuges to a weigh station. Every ounce of material had to be counted before it could be released to the hoppers. Somewhere, someone was keeping score. Joe led me to the giant closed garage where we watched a fresh load drop into the black back of an 18-wheeler. They carry 25 tons, said Joe. It didn't take very long before the truck's hold was filled, at which point a black hood automatically unfurled across the top. The truck pulled out, the 18th that day, to rumble from the Ward's Island dewatering plant and into the streets. No one would have suspected the nature of its contents. I asked who ran the trucks. Nyofco, said Joe. NYOFCO, Nyofco, was the New York Organic Fertilizer Company, which was itself a wholly owned subsidiary of another company called Sinagro. And what was Sinagro? In 2005, Sinagro Technologies, Inc. somehow managed to sell nearly 500,000 tons of human waste for revenues of $338 million. The company did its business on 1 million acres of land in 37 states, and had signed deals with 600 colossal collectors for the drying, composting, incineration, and product marketing of human waste. The New York Organic Fertilizer Company was just one of many Sinagro subsidiaries. I asked Joe what Nyofco did with my waste after they hauled it from Ward's Island. They sell it to the Arabs, he said. It works in the desert. When I first set off on the trail of waste from the sewer to wherever it finally ended up, no matter how close or far away, I was following the money. Contrary to its name, waste can be useful. Human turd has polished gold, bleached wool, and helped produce salt and cheese. Innumerable tradesmen have used it to tan leather, adulterate opium, eradicate dandruff, ink tattoos, promote hair growth, and brush their teeth. Much to the delight of professional bakers, the General Homeopathic Journal in 1886 reported that chemists have evidently no difficulty in demonstrating that water impregnated with extract of water closet has the peculiar property of causing dough to rise particularly fine. That's a quote. In the early 1980s, the Environmental Protection Protection Agency began a campaign to acclimate U.S. consumers to the commercial use of human waste. Touted as superior to cow manure and commercial fertilizers, ton after ton of EPA-subsidized sludge and cake arrived in low-income rural areas, distributed free of charge to cash-strapped farmers. The EPA knew the ocean dumping days would soon be gone, knew that the future of waste would lie much closer to home. In fact, the Ocean Disposal Ban Act of 1988 specifically barred human waste from the sea, which meant a sudden need for more holding tanks, more solid waste treatment plants, more monstrous black hoses, more blue Humboldt centrifuges, and entirely new industries. Sinagro Technologies calls itself the largest recycler of biosolids in America, the only national corporation focused exclusively on what has come to be known as the organic residuals industry, a market Sinagro hopes will generate $8 billion annually. But it turns out that as the waste revolves, commercial opportunities abound. You may have given it away, but if you want it back, you'll have to pay for granulite, myelorganite, soil-rich, vital cycle, or many of the other wonder soils available from Agway, Home Depot, Kmart, Target, Walmart, or your local purveyor of organic fertilizer. And that's just the beginning. You can trust your investment in these little guys because the big guys are in on it too. Dow, Honeywell, Monsanto, Siemens, and Toshiba. The economic potential of human waste has driven new research agendas for toxic code genomics, odor streams, and vapor media. An industry chemistry of coagulation and flume has arisen, a new biology of micronutrients, microspores, putrescible organics, and the human interceptor, which is waste speak for you and me. Will waste become an agribusiness, a biopolymer business, a farm business, an energy business? Once everyone gets over the mental hump of cadaverine and putrescine, why not consider futures and options trading on the transcontinental waste exchange? The all-waste society masquerades as the zero-waste society, an antiseptic land where death itself has been transformed into biocide.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network because you can handle the truth.
You're listening to Expansion on republicbroadcasting.org, the RBN network. This is Sophia, your host, and today I am reviewing a rather fascinating, extraordinarily expansive article from the February 2008 issue of Harper's Magazine entitled Wasteland. Now, I've been reading excerpts from this article, but I just want listeners to know that I've left out huge swaths of it, which are very informative, so I urge you to look online or go to the library and get this 2008 February issue of Harper's and read Fred Kaufman's very enlightening piece here. Now, I will continue. We just left the big, huge barge in Manhattan and loaded with waste, and we're talking about biosolids. Not everyone has been convinced that the miraculous future, convinced of the miraculous future of human waste. From the Bronx to Temescal Canyon, complaints have arisen about a grave threat to nature and humanity. The citizens of Kern County, California, fought to ban the dumping of human waste, which the local Green Acres farm had eagerly adopted to fertilize the wheat, alfalfa, and corn they sold as seed to nearby dairy farms. No one in Kern County wanted to drink the milk that flowed from cows, that ate the feed, that grew from pellets, that arrived from Nyofco, that came from Ward's Island, that emerged from North River, that had come from me. Human waste is, of course, one of the oldest fertilizers known to human beings. But the future of waste must take into account a few salient facts. You and your next-door neighbor may be hooked up to a sewer, but so are DuPont, Monsanto, 3M, and your local hospital. Content surveys have uncovered dioxins, furans, a coplanar, polychlorinated biphenyls, not to mention the germs of pneumonia and encephalitis. In 1993, the EPA assessed 126 priority pollutants in solid waste. Arsenic, lead, and mercury led the way. And so the reported incidence of disease near fields of waste and the growing roster of men, women, and children suffering from blisters, boils, nose scabs, pleurisy, and fungus in the lungs. So the reports of hundreds of cows wasting away and dying on farms outside of Augusta, Georgia, cows fed from hay fields fertilized with the sewage of the residents of Augusta, Georgia. Every year, America processes more than 5 million dry tons of sewage sludge. Much of it is slingshot into forests or injected beneath the surface of the earth, and the remainder fills strip mines and gravel pits or rumbles off to turf farms, aqua farms, tree nurseries, or state parks. Some of the waste creates the rolling greens of your local golf course, the fresh soil of your cemetery, the fertilizer on your front lawn. Cows graze on treated pasture as well as on field corn and sweet corn grown on human waste. Heinz and Del Monte have taken a cautious approach and decided not to accept ingredients grown on land treated with biosolids. Then again, some organic farmers have reported that human fertilizer raised the protein content of their wheat. Robert Boucher grew up in Dover, New Hampshire, 117 miles of sewer lines and one wastewater treatment plant. His father sold garbage trucks, containers, and equipment, and Bob worked summers for Dad, cleaning out used cans and repainting them. He went to Northeastern to play offensive guard, but soon dropped out and went to work in the family business. A company called American Waste gave him his first stab at management, and Boucher began to ascend the corporate ladder. He eventually landed a job at Allied Waste, one of the largest general waste companies in America. This was big money garbage, and Boucher found himself in charge of $1.5 billion in revenues. After he'd spent a number of years at Allied, bankers came knocking on his door. They recognized a man that they could trust with the future, and they made Boucher chief operating officer of Synagro. In 2003, he became CEO. Now, our author is interviewing Robert Boucher, CEO of Synagro. Recently, actually, Synagro was bought by no other than one of the world's largest private equity firms, the Carlyle Group. And the price paid for Synagro Technologies was $776 million. I asked Robert Boucher how he perceived human waste in terms of the U.S. economy. I think of it from the service aspect, said Boucher. Running my business as efficiently as possible keeps our shareholders happy, our customers happy, our bankers happy. But what about the actual substance? The material we handle is tougher than garbage, he said. People don't want to think about it. When you flush your toilet, you take it for granted until the day it comes back at you. Then you have to deal with it. When you go to the commode, that's the end of the process for you, but the beginning for us. We make it go away. How about the energy, I asked. When would waste emerge as an alternative to gasoline? Let's get our arms around this, he said. I can't tell you this is an energy business from the standpoint of reusable fuel. There's not enough volume. Not enough volume? Boucher shook his head. What about Big Pharma? What about DEET and Chanel? He shook his head. No penicillin recovery, no decaffeinated sludge? He shook his head. What about metal reclamation? Wasn't this pellet some sort of renewable source of aluminum and chromium? It's almost a non-detect, said Boucher. Clearly, he took me for a fool. He had plenty of reasons to conceal what he and his cronies were up to. He was playing dumb, and I was falling for it. His lawyer, there was a lawyer in the room taking notes. His lawyer looked up from his notes and waited for my next question. What was my next question? I checked the list. What about building materials? It turned out not to be so cost-effective, said Boucher. He gave me a look. Perhaps he was appalled by my ignorance. Perhaps he didn't care, but he understood his product and knew the notion of its glorious future was but another symptom of our desire to deny. Despite the primitive and absurd fantasy that we might refine what lay dark within ourselves and reform it into something fabulous, there was no glorious future of waste. Now, this is according to the CEO of Synagro Technologies. Our article, I finished reviewing it, and I have loads of questions after reading this. First of all, do we know what's happening after we flush the toilet? Do we know what they are doing with it in terms of possibilities? And my second question is the $64,000 question that I have to admit I didn't really think of myself. Someone else posed it to me when I was telling her about this incredible article I had read that had opened my mind. And she said, why are we pooping in our water? And I had never thought of it like that. Here we have this commodity, this resource that they're telling us is endangered, that there isn't enough water, according to the greenies, for everyone who lives on this earth. Why are we using it to put our waste in? Animals don't do that. We never did that when we lived on the land. Why is this urban planning system making us use this resource, ruining it, and then creating all kinds of hazards with it? So I want to invite on the line William Roberts, unless we have any callers who would like to come in. But William Roberts is an urban planning specialist, I guess you could say. He has his own show here on RBN that follows my show, but his is daily. And he's had extensive experience in land use development and civil engineering. So do we have William on the line?
Can you hear me?
Yes, now I can hear you.
Okay, there you go.
Yeah, William, I sent you a copy of this article. What did you think of it?
Well, it was long, it was detailed, it was very explanative. It opened up to the general public eye, something that's been going on for a very long time. I think it was really written to capture your mind, and it did. And I think we all need to look at this because this is really just not something that we actually sit down in the living room and chat with, and is very rarely ever discussed on air. As a matter of fact, Sophia, I congratulate you. I think you're the first to ever bring it up on the independent media. And yet, at the same time, it's fundamental to every single one of us. So we can go back to, you know, in that article, I like the way that they started it. There's tons of material in my reference library on this, of course, because it's an interest area of mine. It's a career. It was a career choice, professional inquiry. I started out in 1969 as an office boy drafter after having spent years in the vocational drafting program in high school and junior high school. And I started as an office boy at what was then Hill & Ingman, which became Hill, Ingman & Chase, which became URS Company. And at the time, it was the largest multidisciplinary engineering company in the world. And I worked my way up to an engineering design technician without ever passing through college. So basically, in those days, you could come in and apprentice and learn the craft and learn the trade. And what I started out doing, basically, was working with the survey department, plotting maps, making topographical maps, doing what is known as reducing the survey notes and things like that, and then went on to become involved in the design of lateral sewer extension projects for the various clients that we had in the Pacific Northwest around the Seattle-King County area, and that included lift stations, pumping stations, assessment maps and assessment roles and all of that, all the way to sewage treatment plants and roads and water and everything that you could imagine coming out of a civil engineering office. So I guess I learned a long time ago that poop flows downhill. And it flows in a water carriage system. And as we've spoken before, You know, we have to ask ourselves, why are we pooping in our water? Well, primarily, John Crapper's toilet addressed a very serious and pressing issue, particularly for the eastern seaboard and the rising communities in the in San Francisco and the little budding town of Seattle and other places, Los Angeles. But when you have a density, a high density, and multiple stories like the five-story brownstone walk-ups in the East Village, I've been there, I've been in the buildings, I've walked up. But you can tell that the bathrooms were an afterthought in those buildings because they're down the end of the hall and everyone shares them. And then under the kitchen sink is you can find a bathtub. Most unusual situation you've ever seen in your life. But you can see that all the plumbing was added after these buildings were created. And just visualize, if you will, a dear little 72-year-old mama, grandma sitting up there in her fifth-story apartment, and she's faced with this pail that she needs to get out to the street on a regular basis daily. And John Crapper's toilet was a godsend, because if you can just flush the hammer and let that water carry everything down to the street, well, it solves all those problems, doesn't it? But then, like you said, once you flush that hammer, you push the lever down, you think perhaps that it goes to the center of the earth. But as we've heard in the article, Sophia, that's not the case, is it?
No, and it's amazing what is the case. I mean, it has to be separated out, and the water is back on the street in 6 hours? That's incredible.
Well, it's if they have that capability, I think that it's not just incredible, it's almost miraculous. Because I've never known anything to move through quite that quickly before. It's in a completely new to me. But if they've got their technology up to that level, well, then they have certainly earned their stripes and got their Navy. But typically, it doesn't work that way. It takes quite a bit longer than that to process water. There's a long process that happens. And it starts basically... You can follow the sewage all the way down the system to the treatment plant. And the first thing, of course, that is necessary to do is the removal of solids.
Right. And I also, I want to mention in this article, they describe the 11-mile long sewage interceptor. Now, the toilet is the drug pusher's best friend. When the cops bang on the door, the drug pusher flushes his stash. People flush their prescription medications when they don't want to take them anymore or they're outdated. People flush all kinds of things. Counterfeit money is flushed. And the sewage interceptor pulls out, I guess, not just solids, but actual, you could call them artifacts. In fact, they even describe that there are puppies that are swimming in this, that people have thrown into the sewer system. And they've rescued them. They've become mascots of the treatment plants. You know, so I wanted to throw in that element of recoverable material.
Well, we really do need to understand that because the toilet is, you know, especially before the advent of the garburator, the garbage disposal, it was pretty much the place that you put the jello that you couldn't finish or the fruit or whatever it was, anything that you could flush down the toilet, anything you could stuff down the toilet, you'd try and do that, and if you could get it to go away that way, you know, you'd do it. Diapers and all of the rest go in the same category. But also, children are fascinated, and pets are fascinated with the toilet. And a cat, when they figure out how to pull the handle down, could definitely flush a toilet. If it happens to be a mother cat with a litter of kittens, it wouldn't be a surprise to lose a couple of kittens down the drain. So there's all kinds of things that go down there. But the very first project is then the separation of the solids, trying to get all the trash out of it and deal with that. And then we start going through a lengthy process, which we really don't need to go into too much, on how it will actually then go back to clearer water. I wouldn't ever get to the point where I'm willing to step up there and take a drink out of it. That takes a leap of faith a little more than I have. But it's certainly clean enough or clear enough then to put into a lake or put recharge back into this groundwater system, into the aquifers. But we've got new problems. We've got really new problems, and we've got some hanging on persistent old problems. But with the pill world, the super pharmacopoeia that we've become, a lot of the pills that we take I don't like to use the inclusive we there. I don't use any drugs. I don't even use aspirin. But I do smoke cigarettes and I drink coffee, but that's not part of this problem. But the concept here is that a lot of these pills don't digest. And so these pills show up in whole form at the sewage treatment plant as bobbing little floating things, and they get skimmed off. They're skimmers. And so what do you do with that? And then there's the other stuff. You know, somebody's got a pint of denatured alcohol, and they used it to thin some paint or something like that, and they're stuck with this thing. Well, let's just dump it on the toilet. And that's what happens. And that's the problem that we've got, is a lot of chemical hazard waste in the sewage.
Well, we're going for a three-minute break, and we'll be back on the other side to pick up on this subject. You're listening to Expansion on RBN, republicbroadcasting.org. This is Sophia, your host, and today I'm talking about waste management, which our second, I guess, participant, William Roberts, who's also an RBN host, has told us is a whole new and rather problematic, expansive, extraordinary, I guess you could call it enterprise. You were telling us, William, that there are pills that have to be skimmed off from as they, I guess, recoup materials in the first level of processing.
Right. The first stage of the sewage treatment process really is dealing with the solids and the sediment, the things that are going to be either floating. Things that are not related to human fecal matter or urine, things that are not related to the others. Let's break it down a little bit so we can understand really more of what's going on. First of all, we've got stormwater. Now, stormwater should not be involved in this process at all. But that's where the great aqueducts and some of the things that they transported water into Roman aqueducts, but they also conveyed away the stormwater. And they discovered early on in that process that they could not allow people to put their waste in along with that water because of the problems that it would come from that. And so we start off with stormwater. And then in our households, we have what we consider to be in the civil engineering business as gray water. That's the water that is running in your sink, and that's the water that you bathe in, you wash your face, and you brush your teeth and all that. That's gray water. And then we have the human excrement, the urine and the feces. And so if we divide all that up and understand that there's very little work to be done when we talk about what comes out of your washing machine, out of your kitchen sink, to a lesser degree, your tub, to a greater degree, the garbage disposal system, adding in there another trouble, all of those things together can be pretty well easily dealt with. But when you go around, and as you started the broadcast, when you start pooping in the water, then we've got a real problem. We've got a conundrum in this. And so the horns of this dilemma are best addressed by trying to figure out, is that a smart plan? And in the future, do we want to continue this practice? But looking back in the old days, even in England, jolly old England, and then into the eastern seaboard where this system started to be developed, we had the idea of convenience. You know, George Washington went to an outhouse. If we break it up into another aspect and think about it from the standpoint of dense urban, suburban, and rural, we have three more big questions that come into this mix that can be understood only by really examining them in detail. And so it's a huge thing. The idea that we can just casually turn our back on this as a problem is the epitome of human ignorance and arrogance. So there's much to be learned here.
Well, we have our short top of the hour break, and I'd like to pick up with a couple of questions on the other side.